From the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, this is NIH Research Radio. Welcome to episode 14 of NIH Research Radio, with news about the ongoing medical research at the National Institutes of Health, the nation's medical research agency. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfeld. Coming up on this edition of NIH Research Radio, I'll head over to the Clinical Center and discuss what the National Cancer Institute is doing to combat various cancers that are connected with HIV/AIDS. My guest will be Dr. Robert Yarchuin, Chief of NCI's HIV/AIDS and Malignancy Branch. Wally Akinso will tell us how new information shows obese men who wish to become fathers may have something other than their weight to worry about. As students return to school, several middle school students around the country will take part in a study that aims to lower the risk of type 2 diabetes in teens. Wally will be back with a story about how people who start chronic drinking at an early age are less likely to seek out treatment for alcohol abuse. But first, a new device that received research support from the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute has just been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. That's straight ahead on NIH Research Radio. A key to good health is eating healthy foods. So, when you're dashing around the supermarket, dash to the produce aisle for fresh fruits and vegetables. Dash to the dairy case for low-fat milk products. Dash to the foods that are lower in saturated fat, trans fat, cholesterol, sodium, and added sugars. Dash to the foods that have been proven in the fight against high blood pressure. For more information about the DASH eating plan, log on to www.dashplan.org. This message brought to you by the National Institutes of Health and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved the first totally implanted artificial heart for patients with advanced heart failure in both of the heart's pumping chambers. The National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute at the National Institutes of Health supported the research, which led to the development of the device, which is intended for patients who are not eligible for a heart transplant and whose life expectancy without the device is only a month. Dr. Daniel Schultz, director of the FDA's Center for Devices and Radiological Health, announced the approval during a recent teleconference.
Today's approval represents a significant step in the evolution of this important technology and allowing it to come to the marketplace in a way that we feel best serves the needs of the American public. We hope that today's approval will encourage the continued development and refinement of this technology. And in fact, we know that investigators are continuing to work on these products and that further refinements will make this product safer and more effective in the future and hopefully allow it to be used earlier on in the process of heart failure for larger populations.
Since the 1960s, the NHLBI has funded extensive basic research to develop a range of mechanical heart support devices, including the total artificial heart and ventricular assist devices. About 5 million people in the United States suffer from heart failure, and it contributes to or causes about 300,000 deaths per year. We've all heard stories about how the kids today seem to act as if they're gonna live forever, and as a result, they'll sometimes take risks with their health and safety. Wally Akinso has a report about how people who become chronic drinkers at an early age are less likely to seek out treatment.
Youngsters who are alcohol dependent before they turn 25 are less likely to seek treatment than those who become alcohol dependent at age 30 or older, according to a study by the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. They also are more likely to have multiple dependence episodes of longer duration and are likely to meet more dependence diagnostic criteria than those who become alcohol dependent later in life. According to Dr. Ralph Hinkson, NIAAA's Director of the Division of Epidemiology and Prevention Research.
I think that the conventional view that many people have is that alcoholism is a problem of people who are in their middle age. What this indicates is that actually people are diagnosable with alcohol dependence at a much, much younger age, and it emphasizes the need for prevention, that parents need to be vigilant, set clear standards for their children, monitor their behavior, make sure there's open communication, and involve children in family activities. We know parents can make a difference in reducing or preventing alcohol problems among young people.
Dr. Hinkson said, that marital, family, or work responsibilities among young drinkers may help explain why persons who can be diagnosed with alcohol dependence at early ages are less likely to recognize and seek treatment for their drinking-related problems.
People who start to drink at a young age and who become dependent at a young age are more likely to be unintentionally injured under the influence of alcohol, both during adolescence and adult life, to be in motor vehicle crashes because of drinking, both during adolescence and adult life, and to be in physical fights after drinking, both during adolescence and adult life. Why is that important? It's important because injuries are the leading cause of death in the United States for people ages 1 through 44. CDC estimates that there are approximately 40,000 injury deaths every year in the United States attributable to alcohol. So we need to make sure that our legal drinking age is enforced and that parents set clear standards for young people and that our healthcare providers are vigilant about this and query adolescent patients about their drinking and apprise them of the increased risks that are associated with starting to drink at a younger age and the increased risk of developing alcohol dependence at a very young age.
Dr. Hinkson said drinking at an early age predicts early onset of dependence, which in turn is associated with chronic relapsing dependence. He believes that screening and brief motivational counseling can reduce alcohol-related problems among adolescents and college students who are heavy drinkers and that such counseling needs to be made more available. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
When we return, I'll take the traveling microphone to the clinical center to visit with a scientist at the National Cancer Institute who's working hard to fight the cancers that go along with HIV/AIDS infection. That's coming right up on NIH Research Radio. Aristotle had this problem, so did Thomas Jefferson, and they went on to do great things. If you stutter, you could do something great too by participating in a National Institutes of Health stuttering study. Participants will be compensated, travel assistance is available, and all study-related tests are provided at no cost. Call 866-999-5553 or visit clinicaltrials.gov. Do something great. The NIH is a nonprofit government agency of the Department of Health and Human Services. This marks the 25th year since the first reported cases of AIDS in 1981. By 1984, thanks to the groundbreaking efforts of investigators at the National Cancer Institute, scientists at the NCI, along with a team at the Pasteur Institute in France, were able to identify the cause of AIDS, the HIV virus. Since that time, there's been much more research, many things learned, more things yet to be learned. They're at the forefront of that effort to find cures for some of the complications, especially cancers, that are associated with HIV and AIDS is Dr. Robert Yarshuin, chief of NCI's HIV, AIDS, and Malignancy Branch. In 1983, he joined Dr. Samuel Broder to work in the National Cancer Institute's newly formed AIDS Therapy Program, along with Drs. Broder and Dr. Hiroaki Mitsuya. Dr. Yarshuin conducted the initial clinical testing of many anti-HIV drugs. Dr. Yarshuin, first of all, thanks for being with us today on NIH Research Radio. Can you tell us about the early days in that research to find effective treatments for HIV?
It was actually a very exciting period. From my own perspective, it was very hard to get any sort of handle on this new disease and how to approach it until the virus HIV was discovered. And actually, the discovery of that virus and the demonstration that it was the cause of AIDS enabled scientists to really focus their effort on ways of treating it for the first time. Dr. Broder had a very small group at the NCI. It was really him, Mitch Mitsuya, and myself. And when it became clear that HIV was the cause of AIDS, we got together and Sam said, look, let's just drop everything and try to develop some sort of cure for this, or at least a good therapy for it. At that time, we really reprogrammed our whole laboratory's effort to do that.
Now, in the early going, there was some suspicion that there might be some recreational drug usage that led to this T-cell deficiency. What tipped you guys off to the fact that it was, in fact, a virus?
Well, I mean, the whole history of looking for the cause of HIV is actually quite interesting to read in retrospect. At the time, there was a group of people that had a group of really bewildering symptoms, and it was pretty reasonable to consider everything that might be going on, and one of them was the possibility that some new drug had gotten into the population. I think the finding that people that had received blood transfusions also came down with HIV or AIDS, made it clear that it was some sort of transmissible agent. And there was then a period of time of really focusing on transmissible agents as the cause. And retroviruses were an area of some suspicion for a while. HTLV-1 had been discovered just a couple years before by Bob Gallo and Bernie Poitz, a postdoc then working in his lab. And HTLV-1 is associated with a form of immunodeficiency. So this made people very interested in looking for other retroviruses.
For the layman, when we talk about intramural research, what are we talking about?
Intramural research in the NIH is research that's funded by the U.S. government and takes place on the campuses of the NIH. The main campus is here in Bethesda. There's one in Frederick, Maryland. There's also one out in Montana.
So it was intramural researchers at the NCI that played a key role in the development of drugs for treating HIV infections and AIDS. And I'm talking about the cocktail therapy, which has drastically reduced the number of deaths and new cases of AIDS since it became available in 1995. Tell us a little bit about how you and your colleagues were instrumental in coming up with this therapy.
Well, I mean, I think you have to remember that a cocktail is composed of individual components. And the important thing is to get individual components that work. The first AIDS therapies that were effective really were made available around 1987 or so, and the first drug was AZT. AZT was developed by our lab in collaboration with Burroughs Wellcome Company. When AIDS was found to be caused by HIV, one of the things that we did, and Dr. Mitsuya really spearheaded this effort, was to try to develop an assay to test for drugs that would work. HIV kills T cells, and he developed an assay with a special line to look for drugs that would block the killing of the T cells by HIV. And as soon as he got the assay going, we started testing drugs, some that we got off the shelf ourselves. Dr. Broder ran to different companies to try to identify interested companies, and some of them sent us samples of drugs to test, and one of those was Burroughs Wellcome.
Now, in preparing to chat with you today, I saw where you were impressed by a female patient you had suffering from AIDS, and she had a fungal infection of a fingernail that AZT seemed to help. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, let me just take a couple of steps back. Around the beginning of 1985 or so, several drugs were found to be active against HIV. One of them was a drug sent under code compound S that turned out to be AZT. Also DDC and DDI, which were compounds that we bought from biotech companies or chemical companies, were found to be active. The first one that we tested was AZT because there was some preliminary work and we could get it into people quickly. And our interest at that time was to try to move as quickly as possible. So we conducted a phase one study in which we got people with HIV infection who had some sort of documented evidence of virus in their body. And at first, we saw some patients having increases in their CD4 count. We really didn't have any mechanism of monitoring the virus at that time.
And what is a CD4 count?
I'm sorry, let me take a step back. The CD4 count is a type of T cell that's very important in the body's immune response. And the hallmark of AIDS and HIV infection is that these cells, the number of them goes down and you lose the function of their cells and people start getting these exotic infections. So we saw some patients in which the CD4 count increased. This was of interest to us, but the increases were often fairly subtle, and it wasn't really clear that it was making any difference. We had one patient, a female, who had gotten HIV from a blood transfusion, and she had a fungal infection of her fingernails, which is something that normal people really wouldn't get to this degree. And what we noticed as we treated her with HIV is that suddenly she started growing out normal fingernails, and you could see a line where the fungal infection stopped and the normal...
You mean when you treated her with AZT?
With AZT, forgive me. And this was really clear evidence that not only were we seeing a change in a lab value, but we were making a clinical difference in patients. And actually, as we continued on, we saw this in some other patients as well.
As a researcher, how exciting was that to you?
You know, there was this combination of excitement and not wanting to jump ahead of yourself.
Don't want to jinx it.
Right, jinx it by being too excited and then being disappointed. So one always has to wear two hats in doing this sort of work. One is the hat of being enthusiastic about what you're doing, and the other is the hat of really being steely-eyed and being very critical of your results. And you need to do both simultaneously.
Now, you were talking about symptoms of AIDS, symptoms of HIV, and you mentioned cancers that come up. And I'm talking about Kaposi's sarcoma. And before the AIDS epidemic, that was something nobody ever heard of. And now 10% of the cancers associated in developing countries like Congo and Uganda are Kaposi's sarcomas.
Right.
What's the NCI doing to try to combat that?
Kaposi's is actually very interesting. It's a tumor that was originally discovered in the late 1800s in a population in Eastern Europe. And for a number of years, the reports of this tumor appearing in Eastern Europe and some of the Mediterranean countries, Italy, for example, it was even there reasonably rare. And in this country, occasionally would show up, and one would get all the medical students to come in, see the patient, and they'd be told, look at this case, you'll never see another one in your life. Well, that changed in 1981 when a number of gay men in New York and some cities in California suddenly started developing this tumor, and it was clear that there was something new going on, and that plus pneumocystis pneumonia, which is another opportunistic manifestation of AIDS, was one of the first signs that there was a new disease. In the early days of the epidemic, Kaposi's sarcoma was very common in people with HIV infection. Since the development of HART, and when we say HART, it stands for highly active antiretroviral therapy, and HART really is a combination of some of the earlier drugs that we developed, AZT, DDC, and DDI, plus another class of drugs, often protease inhibitors. And if you mix three of them together, you can often suppress HIV to the point where you really start seeing dramatic improvements in patients. And it's been found since the development of HART that actually the incidence of Kaposi's sarcoma is going down. And in addition, that some patients with Kaposi's sarcoma are treated just by taking antiretroviral therapy. So I think this is a classic example where focusing and the efforts of the NCI in focusing on HIV made a major effort in preventing and also in treating a cancer. So this is one evidence of an interrelationship between the two.
Well, in developed countries, people with HIV/AIDS are living longer, healthier lives in general, but there's still health challenges, the increased risk of cancer, for instance. What's being done here at the NCI under your auspices to combat that?
Our group's working on several levels. One is looking at the cancers associated with HIV. One of the things that has happened is people have taken HART antiretroviral therapy and have had improvement in their immune system. Their risk in any given year of developing one of these classic cancers associated with AIDS, cancers like Kaposi's sarcoma, certain types of lymphoma, particularly lymphoma of the central nervous system or the brain, other types of cervical cancer, have really dramatically decreased, and especially those cancers that are associated with profound immunodeficiency. On the other hand, what is happening is that these patients are living longer, and as they live longer, their risk, their total lifetime risk of developing these cancers actually also increases. So you have this conundrum. They're doing much, much better in the short term, but there's a question of what's going to happen to them 10, 20 years down the line. We're starting to see some sort of change of cancers towards those that occur with higher CD4 cells in people that aren't quite as immunosuppressed. Now, our group is looking at these cancers. It turns out that almost all the cancers that are associated with AIDS are caused by a second virus. Kaposi's sarcoma, for example, is caused by a virus called KSHV. It was just discovered in 1994 by Pat Moore and Yuan Chang, two investigators at Columbia. A lot of the lymphomas are caused by Epstein-Barr virus. So our group is really focusing on the association between these viruses and cancer, trying to really dissect this virus, understand how they cause these cancers, and then look at targeted therapies for these viruses.
So this is a story basically where we've got a lot of successes, we've made a lot of progress, but there's still a long way to go.
Right.
25 years since the first reported cases in 1981. But there's a ripple effect. When you make progress in one area in medicine or in almost any endeavor, you find ways to use what you've learned and apply that to other problems. What are some of the things you look at in the future, other areas that could benefit from the research you've done here at the National Cancer Institute?
Well, let me first of all go back to some of the things that you alluded to, and that is the developing world. A lot of the work that we've done has been really effectively utilized in the United States and other advanced nations economically. In the developing world, though, resource limitations have really limited the access of people to therapy. And there are a lot of work to be done just to bring what we've developed here to those countries. Kaposi sarcoma, for example, the virus that causes it is not evenly distributed in the world. And it turns out that this virus is very prevalent in parts of Africa. And this is a devastating, devastating tumor in Africa, even at this day. In some countries in Africa, it's by far the most common tumor. A lot of the work is in terms of getting the therapies that we've developed and others have developed in this country and applying them in Africa, getting the drugs to treat AIDS to be used in Africa so the Kaposi's can be prevented. And there's a lot more that we need to understand. I think that in the future, we've discovered that these viruses can really cause cancers, particularly in immunosuppressed patients. And one of the important things is dissecting just how these viruses can cause these cancers. Unlike many cancers that are caused by very subtle mutations in cells, these are cancers that are caused by an exogenous agent, an agent outside the body that really affects certain key pathways in the cell. And they're very nice tool for really studying how a good cell can go bad. And a lot of the lessons that we learn from studying these can then be applied to studying other cancers.
Dr. Robert Yarchuan, chief of NCI's HIV and AIDS Malignancy Branch, thanks so much for your time today and for sharing this information with us on NIH Research Radio.
Thanks for coming out.
When we come back, Wally tells us how research shows that overweight men who want to become fathers someday might want to consider shedding a few pounds, and not just for appearance sake. That's straight ahead on NIH Research Radio. Got a youngster around the house who's on the heavy side but is otherwise healthy? The National Institutes of Health would like to talk to you to see what they can learn from your child. Not only are all study-related tests and treatments provided for free, but all participants are compensated. Check out clinicaltrials.gov or call 866-999-1116 for more info. NIH is a nonprofit government agency, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. If, like me, you're a man who's carrying around a few extra pounds, you probably know that you're at risk for a variety of health problems, such as heart disease, diabetes, and stroke. But did you know there's a chance those extra pounds could cost you a chance at fatherhood? Wally Akinzo explains.
Obese men are more likely to be infertile than normal weight men, according to a study by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. Since 1993, researchers have studied couples enrolled in the Agricultural Health Study, which examined factors that impact the health of farmers and their families in agricultural communities. Dr. Donna Baird, an NIEHS epidemiologist with the study, said women who are overweight or obese tend to have a difficult time becoming pregnant than normal weight women. But whether men who are overweight or obese also have fertility problems had not been studied until now.
We found that men's BMI, which is a body mass index, as it increased, so did their risk of infertility. So men with BMI of 32 to 34, which is considered in the obese range, had about twice the odds of infertility as men with a normal BMI, like 20 to 22, which is considered normal weight. So based on data from this study, an increase in weight of about 20 pounds would be expected to increase the risk of infertility by about 10%.
The data on infertility and body mass came from questionnaires that about 1,500 farmers and their wives completed when enrolled in the study. Dr. Baird said this study provides data on some additional health problems associated with obesity. For more information, visit www.niehs.nih.gov. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
As students around the country head back to class for the new school year, hundreds of sixth graders will find themselves taking part in a study sponsored by the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases. It's called the Healthy Study, and it will determine if changes in school food services and physical education classes, along with activities that encourage healthy behaviors, will lower risk factors for type 2 diabetes. Dr. Gary Foster of Temple University is the study chair. He said 42 two middle schools will take part in the 2.5-year study.
Half the schools will remain as they are, and the other half will get a combination of interventions. One will focus on the total food service environment, so that's everything from foods that are served in the cafeteria to fundraising to what's served at sporting events, etc. But so clearly the focus is going to be in the school cafeteria. The other focus will be on increasing both the quantity and the quality of physical education. We're going to do activities that engage more of the kids in moderate to vigorous physical activity. So, for example, instead of having 18 kids watching two kids pass a ball or shoot a basket, we're going to get kids involved more in duos or trios so that all the kids can be more active. And the bottom line is really to do PE in a different way than it's typically done. The third component, education, that's done in a fun way through charades or through word searches or in the classroom. It's only 15 to 30 minutes once a week, and it'll be done typically during a homeroom period or its equivalent, so it won't take away from any academic instruction. But it'll help kids build a fund of knowledge about why it's important to drink water rather than sugar-added beverages, why it's important to be active rather than zoning out in front of the TV.
After 2.5 years, the students will be tested for diabetes risk factors, including blood levels of glucose, insulin, and lipids. They'll also be measured for fitness level, blood pressure, height, weight, and waist circumference. Once only seen in adults, type 2 diabetes has been rising steadily in youth. Results from the study are expected in 2009. And with that, we come to the end of another edition of NIH Research Radio. Please join us on Friday, September 22nd, when episode 15 of NIH Research Radio will be available for download. These stories are also available on the NIH Radio News Service website, www.nih.gov/news/radio. Our daily 60-second feature, NIH Health Matters, is heard on nearly 1,000 radio stations nationwide, as well as on XM Satellite Radio and on the HealthStar Radio Network. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to contact me. Contact info is right there on the podcast webpage. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfelt. NIH Research Radio is a presentation of the NIH Radio News Service, part of the News Media Branch, Office of Communications and Public Liaison, in the Office of the Director at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, an agency of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.